Right. Well, that's an interesting point, because what you bring to the fore then is an issue of who are representatives accountable to? And there seems to be two constituencies. There's the people of the country themselves, but then there's a second constituency, and that's the foreign investors. It seems that what we're having right now is a contest as to who's going to determine the fate of these countries. Could you maybe give us an example of one case in particular? When we spoke briefly, you said you were quite familiar with the Bolivia situation. Perhaps you can start us with maybe what's happened with the water wars, and then also continue on today into the gas wars.
Well, I think the best example of what you described is the gas war, because there you have, even after, well, the government had made a plan to export natural gas through Chile to Mexico and then ultimately California. And this was through, I think, a series of almost 80 contracts made with multinational gas and energy corporations. And when this plan sort of was put forth by the government, there was a pretty huge outpouring of dissatisfaction with that idea. And people really took to the streets. It sort of started in the highland provinces with sort of very minimal demands, and just sort of snowballed into this thing where they were, ultimately wanting the president to resign, a complete halt of the plan to export the gas, and a nationalization of the gas. And so that mobilization ended up toppling the sort of pro-U.S. government of Sánchez y Lozada. And then the
And
next
that was
president,
exactly when,
that
Tev?
was, sorry, that was October 2003.
Okay.
And so then his vice president, Carlos Mesa, becomes president and says, one of the sort of sticking points of his taking power was that he said that he was going to put the question of the gas exportation to a national referendum. And when this national referendum was sort of drawn up, I think it was even actually rumored to have been written in Washington. But then, it was put forth to the people, and it was written in such ambiguous terms that it was basically left to the Congress and ultimately the president to really decide what that meant. So while you had everybody in the country, well, not everybody, but the
Right.
social movement specifically, asking for a nationalization, and that's, what most people envisioned that they were voting for when they voted for the questions in this referendum, the referendum ends up passing, but then you have the sort of pressure put on by, gas companies, and then just the sort of pressure put on in general by the sort of scaring off of private investors, which most of these countries, really depend on.
Right.
So, this referendum was passed, and then even though it was put forth in this democratic matter, sorry, in this democratic way, and voted on democratically, and passed pretty resoundingly by the public, even, when it's that simple and that straightforward, you have this sort of intervention by, international capital. So, like you were describing, yeah, there are two constituencies, and we're still seeing the international capital one sort of coming out on top because of the sort of weakness of governments.
Now, in Bolivia, it was also just, I think, maybe last month that the nation, there was a nationwide blockade. Is that correct? What exactly has transpired from that? And I thought Mesa, wanted to resign, and the Congress denied him. But what has happened since? See, this is the most difficult thing. You catch glimpses of these stories, but if you rely on corporate media or mass media, you find nothing of this in the news.
Yeah, that one, I can imagine people being really confused about that, because the country had basically been, like you mentioned, blockaded, and he was saying that he couldn't govern, and so his sort of way of getting out of that was to submit a resignation. But it was sort of a half-hearted resignation. What he was really trying to do was sort of prompting the social movements to say, oh, he's saying, okay, you want to block the country, you want to make, my policies null and void from the outset, then fine, I'll resign. And the sort of line of succession is such that it would only bode even worse for the social movement. So what happened then is that he submitted his resignation, And it was rejected twice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of this challenge to the social movement to say, okay, like, this is what you want. Like, look how bad it could get if I do resign. So you better, you know, sort of back off. And they sort of did.
Mm-hmm.
At least the movement towards socialism, which is the sort of representative of the Cocaleros led by Evo Morales.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of block of the social, because there's a lot of social movements in Bolivia, and the Cocaleros are a big part of it. And they sort of did, they sort of blinked. So
right.
Now you have the gas issue being sort of debated in Congress, and whether the contracts are constitutional and how they're going to sort this whole thing out. It's really a pretty big mess.
Right. And that's something that I find so interesting, is that the very process of nationalizing oil or petroleum industries is a pattern that could be found. I mean, it's going back to Iran in 1953. Any country that attempts to nationalize a petroleum or mining industry, extractive industries, basically, has met with nothing but, I would say, strong and violent opposition, sometimes violent opposition from Washington. But what Washington has touted then is to follow the IMC policies, adopt austerity programs. And if we were to look in Latin America, the one country that did this so successfully throughout the 90s was Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that literally crippled and blew up at the end of the 1990s, or was it 2000? Perhaps you could share with the listener something about the Argentinian story, that even though they followed all the policies, it still resulted in some rather tragic economic decline.
I mean, I think there's a lot of, it's easy to sort of, it's hard to put your finger on one thing that Argentina did wrong, because I think there's a lot of things, and a lot of responsibility can be put on, you know, if not the vast majority of responsibility, be put on these policies that were designed in Washington and primarily pushed by the IMF, but other institutions as well. But I mean, if you look at, for example, one component of these policies, which is privatizations, which is pretty, I think, relevant to what we've talked about so far,
mm-hmm.
is that you have a huge sector of the population and in many cases, some of the most organized sectors of the population being sort of pushed out on the street in Argentina. The sort of telltale example is the oil workers, petroleum workers, who ended up, once they became unemployed by the privatization of these companies, which as the process goes, it sort of slashes the workforce to a much more skimpy amount to save money, basically,
sure.
for the private company. So you have these people sort of being shut out of this work that they've depended on for so long. And what they did in Argentina, which is still a movement that exists to this day and is very powerful, is that they organized as unemployed workers to sort of petition the government for social programs, subsidies, work, you know,
mm-hmm.
A variety of different things that the state is actually throughout these, because of these policies, is even less likely to be able to provide, because with such as the, neoliberal policies, what they basically do is shrink the state to the point where all these sorts of programs and all these sort of economic roles that the state used to play in the 50s and 60s especially is left to private companies.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a group of people in the piqueteros, for example, which are these unemployed, organized unemployed workers. They're demanding things, and the state sometimes is pressured into giving into them, but with the role of the state so drastically reduced, it's even harder for the state to provide these things, creating a pretty sort of a catch-22 where, you know, you have people asking for things that the state can't provide. Another reason they can't provide it is because they don't own state companies that generate revenue, so it's this sort of vicious cycle.
Right. Right. We're going to jump around because, again, what we wanted to try to do is conclude today with just a broad overview. I find that so many people know little about the kind of civil unrest and dynamism as well in Latin America, and so this is just trying to take a snapshot. And if you would be interested in phoning in and speaking, directing a question to Teo Balbeb, please feel free. The number here is 607-777-2137. Perhaps at the end of the conversation we could take a call or two. I'd also like to turn then to the issue in Mexico. I just saw news accounts that on Sunday, yesterday, 1.2 million people assembled in Mexico City. Now, if I weren't doing my investigating on the internet, I would look at that and say, why? Could you explain the story behind this?
Well, Mexico, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners will probably know, was ruled for 70 years by party, which is the PRI. And then, well, basically it stems from the mayor of Mexico City, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's from the Party of the Revolutionary, or the Democratic Revolution, the PRD. And he's a popular mayor, and has his base of support is Mexico City, but he's increasingly gotten a lot of support from the countryside as well.
And he's the current mayor of Mexico City?
Yes, he's the
Okay.
current mayor of Mexico City. And he is has all polls have shown him to be the leading presidential candidate for the elections, which are, shoot, now I forget, 2006, I think. And so yeah, and so he's leading the polls, and the sort of two main parties, which is the PRI and the PAN, which is the PAN is the party of President Fox, sort of join together, which they normally don't, but they sort of join together to attack him. And basically, in Mexico, politicians have an immunity towards prosecution for charges against them. And the mayor in Mexico City, this was, you know, years ago, ignored a court order of he wanted to build an access road or widen a road to a hospital, essentially. And in doing so, ignored a court order. So this sort of obscure, really pretty minor infraction, I mean, compared to the sort of corruption and things that people are immune for from prosecution for in Mexico, it's you know, a speck compared to what the PRI and the PAN, you know, are frequently accused of. And so they voted in Congress and successfully got stripped him of his immunity. And by Mexican law, if you're under indictment, you can't run for president. So it's seen across all sectors. I mean, I think I can pretty safely say this, that it's seen through all sectors of Mexican society, you know, even people on the right and center, as you know, this march on Sunday shows, 1.2 million people, that's a huge amount. So it's not just people, his supporters. You have people actually marching in the streets that aren't necessarily voting for this guy, but are saying, you know, you can't disrupt a democratic process in such a blatant way. And I think what's promising about this is that you have Mexico, which is one of the most like electorally corrupt countries, where you have people pouring out in the streets and saying, no, like those days are over. Now you know, a president who has widespread support, or a candidate who has widespread support, is going to run, and you can't stop that. And so, you know, the outcome is far from certain, but it's promising to see this mobilization.
Absolutely. And then speaking of presidents and civil discord in Ecuador, I believe it was just last week that President Lucio Gutierrez, who was the third elected president in the last 8 years, that was ousted. But there's some questions about the legality of the de facto government under former Vice President Alfredo Palacio. What are some of the issues that the citizens and the social movements were bringing to the fore in their demands for Gutierrez's resignation?
You have certainly there's the element, the economic policies. Well, he was elected on a basically anti-Washington consensus platform, and you know, I think it was a month practically by the time he actually took office that he started basically systematically going against his promises. I think a few months into his administration, he signed a deal with the IMF that meant that Ecuador had to raise its gas price fares and its transportation fares, bus fares, which were, I think, two promises that he categorically said that he'd keep in his campaign. So the sort of bait and switch that, that people were certainly for the beginning of his administration upset with. But then towards the end, I mean, he sort of recklessly began making these political deals with opposition parties so that he could stack the Supreme Court, and then it ended up pardoning two former presidents and a vice president who are, you know, widely known to have done some pretty huge corruption scandals during their administrations. And the Supreme Court thing was sort of, I think, the final straw where people finally came out in the streets.
Right.
It was also it wasn't just the indigenous movement, although that they certainly played a huge part, but it was a pretty broad swath of society. You had students, you know, a lot of middle class, like you did in Argentina as well, as I'm sure you had in Mexico on Sunday. So the discontent that we've talked about in all these different places aren't just coming from this radical fringe of a protest movement that, you know, a lot of people sort of suspect that they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty widespread, and that's pretty breathtaking considering the amount of repression and authauthoritarianism that the region has suffered in past years. So to see a sort of
Absolutely.
Vibrant civil society is really encouraging.
Well, then let me ask you this, a final question here. This protest, this opposition to these economic policies, does that translate directly into an anti-Americanism? If you were to take a pulse in Latin America, I mean, we claim to be doing the world a wonderful favor again and spreading democracy throughout the world. But yet we are also living in a time in which anti-Americanism is a serious issue that needs to be dealt with because it can erupt in very violent fashion. Is there a growing surge of anti-Americanism in Latin America as well?
Polls, I've seen one poll especially that was put out by The Economist shows sort of pre-2001 anti-Americanism levels and sort of post-9/11 anti-Americanism sentiment in Latin America. And in almost every country, you saw either a sort of stagnancy in anti-Americanism or an increase.
Hmm.
And it was especially acute in places like Argentina, where you had a sort of economic crisis. So I think that since the policies of the international financial institutions are associated with the U.S. government and the sort of executive administration in particular, I think you are seeing a pretty intense kind of sentiment surging from the region against U.S. policies.
Right.
You know, so I would say that that's sort of accurate, unfortunately.
Okay. Tayo, I just want to give you a chance. If people wanted some information, and I know your website was incredibly helpful, where could they find your website? What's the address, please?
It's www.anacla.org, NACLA.org.
And one of the primary works that your organization puts out is the bi-monthly publication, correct?
Right, yeah.
And can they subscribe to that? Is that and it deals specifically with issues of Latin America, written by distinguished academics, analysts?
Yeah, we have journalists, activists, academics, policy people, and yeah, like you said, it comes out twice a month, and you can subscribe on the site, and we have student rates and everything. So
great.
And it's about Latin American affairs and U.S. policy.
Super. Tayo, I want to thank you again for stepping in today. I told you earlier that I was looking for an intense debate with a Heritage Foundation fella, and I got another congenial ally. But it was a pleasure to speak with you, and I wish you the best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
You too.
Again, that was Tayo Balve. He's the editor of the bi-monthly NACLA report on the Americas, the most widely read English language publication on Latin America. And again, the address for NACLA is www.nacla.org. Again, that concludes the series on Latin America. And this show, as well as other shows, will be archived on my website. That's www.modocpress.com. That's M-O-D-O-C Press, one word. We're going to cut short a little, few minutes today. I just wanted to thank my guest engineer, Dylan, with a host of others who were able to substitute for Jack Walker, my usual stalwart engineer, who is staying home for an extended vacation weekend. Some final comments. One, if you want to find more information about progressive events and outreach in the Binghamton area, I would encourage you to visit Binghamton Independent Media. Their website is www.binghamtonpmc.org. And included there is a weekly newsletter of progressive events and outreach. It's comprehensive, and it will definitely keep you informed of the events. Also, I would like to encourage you to visit, as I've pitched before, a wonderful website for Latin American commentary and investigative journalism, narconews.com. What's so wonderful is we have a local contributor to narconews.com, who also is a contributor at Binghamton Independent Media, Steve Peacock. So you definitely find some great reading there. And please feel free to join the Binghamton Independent Media, which meets twice a month, the first and third Wednesdays of every month, at the Cyber Cafe on the west side of Binghamton at 7 p.m. Usually we meet upstairs. So again, if any newcomers, volunteers, or people interested in video, print, public journalism, come on down. Our motto is Become the Media. I hope that you found some of the information here interesting. It says if you were to pay attention to mass media again, you would find hardly no mention whatsoever of the events that are unfolding in Latin America. But they certainly are powerful, they certainly are pivotal, and they have great significance to the very ideas of social and economic justice. I know that President Chavez has been labeled an authoritarian autocrat. But again, at the Binghamton Independent Media Center site, there is a report from a local longtime activist and academic, Jack Gilroy, who visited Venezuela this winter and basically comments on an entirely different Venezuela that is portrayed in the corporate media. Feel free to stop by the website and read that account. We have only one more show left in Civil Discourse. I want to thank the people who've been listening, the few who've called in, the few who've made comments. I know I've enjoyed this. We'll see you next week here, same time, 4 o'clock on Monday. This is Tariq Abdelazim signing off. Cheers.